My name is Holly Lewis.
I'm Lawson Keeney.
And I am Sean Lewis.
And welcome to The Long Watch, the internet's premier pro-journalistic podcast, where we stick to the list for better or worse. Welcome to episode 200.
Hooray!
And, woo! Like we mentioned at the end of last episode, we weren't going to miss the opportunity to have our 200th episode contain John Lithgow in it. We, of course, have to cover every Lithgow movie we come across upon the list, and it just happened to coincide quite nicely with episode 200. Of course, we'll be talking about the science fiction film Rise of the Planet of the Apes. But before we get into that, we'll talk about what we've seen within the week. Lawson, why don't you start us off?
Sure thing. I have only a couple of things to talk about this week. The first of them is The Guard. It is a crime dramedy directed by John Michael McDonagh, and it is about a highly intelligent, highly bored Irish cop named Jerry Boyle, played by Brendan Gleeson. And he just sort of spends his days in this small Irish town trolling people. He doesn't really take his job seriously. He just sort of pokes people to provoke a reaction. But then some drug smugglers are spotted in his town, and so he is forced to work with / aggravate visiting FBI agent Wendell Everett, played by Don Cheadle. This is so clearly after the Martin McDonagh style, but a little messier and sillier. And that's no surprise, because John Michael McDonagh is Martin McDonagh's brother. It's extremely witty and well-written. It's very funny. And that is mostly down to the character of Jerry. It's a very entertaining performance by Gleeson. It's really a show stealer, a movie stealer. And it works because even though he's an absolute asshole, you still get the opportunities to see the real guy underneath and how he does take the stuff he does seriously when it matters. And, you know, you get some like flashes of personal vulnerability as well with his mother, played by Finola Flanagan, who is dying and is in hospice. The trolling can sometimes step over a line and just end up being too much. Like, he does all this race stuff with the Don Cheadle character, and it's not as funny as the movie thinks it is. I mean, it's hard to be offended by it because it's so clearly trying to provoke a reaction, you know? But it's just saying vaguely racist things and some not even vaguely racist things, and assuming that that's enough to be subversive, and it runs that into the ground over and over and over. And it doesn't help that this character of Wendell Everett is probably the weakest part of the whole story. It kind of feels forced into the script and the story to attract a US distributor. This is really the Gleeson show. And no matter what they try to do to add little extra bits and pieces to it, that is what it comes down to. This is the Brendan Gleeson show. And they try to disguise it. They try to, you know, put Don Cheadle right next to him on the poster, but it's a lie. It's not Don Cheadle's movie, not even close. Everyone else in it is a really sarcastic weirdo. Like, all of the supporting characters and the bit parts, I really dig it. There's very well-written, very funny supporting characters. And it has this sort of dialogue that is prone to random tangents, including some pop culture stuff. And it works, but you sort of get the impression of it being a very particular mix of Martin McDonagh, Quentin Tarantino, and Wes Anderson. Like, it's a very interesting patter. The crime plot sort of just seeps into the background. There's not much depth to it. There's not much going on there. It's really just an excuse for the central character study of the Gleeson character. But that can be a bit of a pity, because when we do spend time with the crooks, they're fun. They're very fun. Like, they've got this, again, sort of very Quentin Tarantino kind of, like, or Fargo. That was another thing that it reminded me of. Fargo. It's sort of like existentialist conversations that they have while they're doing their own work. Like, and the two of the main ones are played by Liam Cunningham and Mark Strong, and they're both very good. But it leads up to an ending that banks on an emotional investment from the audience that it hasn't really earned. It's clever. Functionally, as a piece of narrative, it is a well-constructed thing. But in terms of actually getting the audience invested in it when the time comes, I don't think it's quite gotten there. But there's an absolutely brilliant use of landscapes and scenery. Like this is real Banshees of Inisherin kind of locations. And it just looks gorgeous the whole way through. But if anyone would like to check it out, and I actually would pretty highly recommend it, it's available for streaming in Australia on Stan. Next and last for this week, I saw The Help. It is a historical drama directed by Tate Taylor. It's based on the novel of the same name by Catherine Stockett, and it's set in early 1960s Mississippi, where there is just mega racism all over the place. A generally well-meaning young white woman named Skeeter, played by Emma Stone, decides to write a book with testimony from black maids and black housekeepers that work throughout the area. And she manages to get Abilene, played by Viola Davis, and Minnie, played by Octavia Spencer, to contribute as racial tensions in the town come to a head, which makes this whole excursion, this whole decision to take part, all the more dangerous for Abilene and Minnie. This is sort of like Green Book and Driving Miss Daisy and The Blind Side, those sorts of movies. It's sort of civil rights for dummies. Dummies here meaning white people. It's a very particular type of story about race and about racial relations, that they're stories about white characters being gently convinced that racism is wrong. And
yep.
These movies, they tend to be as much about the white characters. It's their story as much as it is about the black characters, if not more so. Like, there's normally a fairly heavy focus on white characters. It's usually, I found, to be like this, Driving Miss Daisy, Green Book, they're set in the past to give comfort to the white audiences, because then they don't have to think about necessarily modern race relations and asking hard questions. And it's interesting, because I think you can both make arguments about their helpfulness in terms of getting white audiences to think in a way that they hadn't thought before. Maybe not now, but decades ago when they were making them, a lot of them like this. But you can also make an argument for their corrosiveness and their sort of imprinting on a very rigid and a very unchallenging, simple way of looking at race relations that is no longer fit for purpose. And I personally think that at this late hour, they're far too comfortable. You know,
yeah.
I think that's really what it comes down to. The Help is far from the worst example of these, but it still presents damn near every positive development for the black characters as gifted to them by kind and enlightened white people. And it definitely dates the movie. It wouldn't be it would be made today, but it wouldn't pass unremarked the way that it mostly did when it came out in 2011. And
the smart person would have the main character be either Abilene or Minnie.
Yeah. You just got to focus in on the black characters more. Like, that's the thing. It ends up feeling more Skeeter's story than anyone else's. And that's a problem. Like, Viola Davis, I know, has said multiple times on the record that she regrets doing the movie, that she thinks that ultimately it was not a good thing that she did it. I'm sympathetic to that. I think she's maybe being a little too hard on herself. But definitely there are problems here that deserve to be interrogated. And, you know, the thing of it is, as a story itself, it works, you know. Just because you talk about, like, that's the thing that I think sometimes gets lost in conversations like this. Just because it is problematic in this way doesn't mean that it doesn't work as a story. And that it doesn't function well with good writing and with likable characters and good performances that end up with you invested in what's going on. It's just that the whole overall political undercurrent of it is not nearly as dynamic and textured as it should be. It's the Happy Meal version of what something like this should probably be. You know, there's no nutrition there. And, you know, it does work. It's too long. It's more than a little cliche, but it's entertaining. And I will give it credit for some things. It does do some really decent work at illustrating the absurdity of segregation. Obviously, you know, there's a lot about segregation and Jim Crow and all of that stuff that is still very well remembered in the present day by white communities, like all of the, you know, lynchings and all those awful, awful things. And, you know, there's a lot of that sort of more overt, more violent stuff is very well remembered, but it's for someone of our age, all under the age of 30, like sometimes it takes a reminder to remember that, like, they couldn't even eat with the same utensils.
Yeah.
Or
like a lot of people remember those big examples of racism, but it's the little ones that made day-to-day life more difficult than it had to be for black communities. They had a decidedly more difficult time moving through the world.
Yeah, different bathrooms and, you know, just, like, even the like, and it gets into its key plot point in this movie that a lot of these houses that employed black housekeepers would then build outhouses, basically, and force them to use that rather than have them even use the bathroom indoors, which is, you know, these absurdities, that the small, the fine detail that has been not lost to history, but has been perhaps not communicated to younger people as well as it should have been.
The fact that it's not only all of the awful things, but the indignities piled upon it.
Yeah. There are some distressing scenes in terms of how it depicts racism, but it is clear that it has a comfort zone that it's sitting in and that it's not willing to push past. And this is not me. Like, I don't want to see awful, horrifying depictions of racism. Like, that's deeply unpleasant. I don't like to see suffering like that. But at the same time, if you're dealing with this kind of material, it starts and you're like, I keep coming back to it. The movie feels cozy. It shouldn't feel cozy. It shouldn't be the feel-good movie of the year. No, nothing dealing with racism should be the feel-good movie of the year, because even if it has a happy ending in the sense that people become more enlightened and become anti-racist, then you're still left with the depressing reality that they were racist for no good logical reason in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, that's not a triumph. It's a correction of an awful thing to what it should have been all along. Mm. And, like, that's the stuff that I think frustrates me. It's not that I want to see all of these depictions of racism, but when you make it, when it feels like you're holding back, I feel, yeah, it's a bit, it makes me wonder, like, whether you're doing the material a disservice.
Yeah, yeah. I totally agree. When you're making any sort of artwork about that time and about those issues, you actually have to reflect them. Like, it's not going to be enjoyable, it's not going to be comfortable, but that's kind of the point at the end of the day.
There's the most progressive element is the absolute dynamite lineup of actresses that they've got, because this is a movie without a single male main character. Like, this is just packed with this lineup of really exceptional actresses. Obviously, there's Stone and Davis and Spencer, but you've also got in the supporting cast people like Jessica Chastain, Allison Janney, Bryce Dallas Howard, Sissy Spacek, Mary Steenburgen, and they're all really, really good. Like, this is a very well performed movie, and it's really thanks to them that it is as charming and as entertaining as it is. It's well filmed also. It's got very rich production design, costuming. They've really done a good job of recreating the early 60s American South, at least to the eyes of someone who was neither alive in the 1960s or has ever been to the American South. But it feels authentic as you're watching it. And, you know, it uses the Southern landscape, you know, the sort of, like, particular types of plant life and stuff like that. Like, it evokes a place. And I enjoyed it, ultimately. That's the thing. You know, that's, as I said, it works in the capacity that they set out to make it in. But that's why these movies are successful, ultimately. It's why this movie won Oscars, was nominated for even more, made it a boatload of money, was because it did exactly what it set out to do.
We watched this movie in high school for one of our social studies classes. And even then, I was able to recognize this isn't exactly the most forward-thinking film as that it could be. And I also recognized Octavia Spencer and Viola Davis. Octavia Spencer and Viola Davis, they don't miss. They're always good.
It's just, yeah, intellectually, we're all over it. Or most people are, I think. People who actually think about the stories they're consuming are over it. I was and continue to be way more looking forward to movies like Sorry to Bother You and Dear White People than I am, than I was looking forward to watching The Help, which is, again, I enjoyed this. From a purely entertainment perspective, solid 4 out of 5. I had a good time watching it. But, you know, I sort of maybe it's just the hellscape that we all exist in these days, but, you know, I'm looking for sharper edges on this kind of stuff.
You kind of have to roll your eyes a little bit.
Yeah.
When you see how, like, the corners have been sanded
it's
off.
It's like drinking sugar-free Sunkist. It's nice when you're drinking it, but you know there's something missing.
Yeah, and at the end result is, you know, to what end, you know? Why then even bother to get Sunkist if you're going to get the sugar-free version? Why not just go and drink something else instead?
Yeah.
Like, why go to this hollow echo of a thing?
One calorie, not woke enough.
But it's available for streaming in Australia, and I assume everywhere else on Disney Plus, if anyone's interested, because it was actually a Disney movie.
Which tracks.
Yeah.
It feels it.
So for us, we had kind of a sparse week this week. Just quite busy, and a lot of the programs that we were watching as TV shows either continued or had ended. We did watch one movie, though. The Raven.
Yes.
Directed by James McTeague. A serial killer is on the loose and murdering people using the published works of poet and short story writer Edgar Allan Poe, who is played by John Cusack, as sick inspiration for the crimes.
It's basically the TV show Castle with Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, pretty much. You know how it's a cop gets paired with something else?
Mm.
Yeah.
It's like that kind of thing.
An author.
It's like how Lucifer is cop gets paired with the literal devil.
Yeah.
Poe teams up with Detective Fields, played by Luke Evans, a Baltimore policeman, in an attempt to catch the killer by using his knowledge of the depictions of the crimes. Like, he brings Poe on board to be like, hey, just gonna pick your brain a little bit about this. Even though the stories are fictional, they start to become reality, and the killer is always a step ahead of them. This then takes a personal note, as Poe's beloved, Emily, played by Alice Eve, becomes a target and is taken.
Can I
Will
just,
they stop
I,
the killer in time?
I don't want to, like, before you guys say your thing, because I know you guys are way more familiar with the works of Edgar Allan Poe than I am, but I just want to put, because I've referenced this a couple of times over the last episode, but I just want to elucidate what my feelings are on this, because I saw this years ago, like really close to where it came out, probably a decade ago now. And I remember it being complete and utter trash, but so very entertaining. That's where I ended up landing on it. And I'm not sure what your guys' reaction was, but I just wanted to put that out there just to see.
You're not mostly wrong. I will push a little bit back on the trash part of it, but John, say your short piece about it.
Yeah. This is a pulp novel. This is one of those situations where, like we said, it is detective being paired with something amazing, like an author or, I don't know, a leather chair or the literal devil.
Isn't there like a one-season TV show in America that was like a cop and a magician?
Probably. Like, this
there
is kind of...
But, like, there's the mentalist. He wasn't a magician, technically.
Yeah, he was just a mentalist.
No, I'm thinking of something else. Like, the mentalist lasted, like, 7 seasons.
Yeah. With a ending that disappointed the shit out of me, because I was watching it, and Red John was not who I anticipated. My choice would have been better. I'm still on that.
I haven't thought about the mentalist in a yonks age. So... I don't know why it's still rattling around in your cranium. But on topic of the Raven, I really enjoyed this for what it was, which was a pulpy crime thriller featuring Edgar Allan Poe. Cusack as Poe is perfect sort of end of his life, really pissing everybody off, not making any friends, and it's sort of exactly what those first few autobiographies of Poe painted him as, an opium-addicted drunkard who would get into fights regularly. And it plays into that aspect of things.
It's a tad bit more flattering than that.
The use of Poe is really interesting, and the use of his works are really interesting. You've got references to The Cask of Amontillado, Pit and the Pendulum, The Raven, obviously, Murders at the Rue Morgue, Mask of the Red Death, and there are even some other ones like references to Lenore, the poem, references to The Black Cat, the other things like that. You've got these little bits of C. August Dupin in Luke Evans' character, the fact that he's this detective who is trying to put these pieces together. But at the end of the day, it is a lot of aesthetic, and if you really think about the plot for even a little bit, you realize that none of it makes terribly much sense at all, that there's a lot of convenience in here to try and get us to the ending. But I really like the way that the ending is played here. It's honest with the way that Poe passed away. But there are some other things surrounding that, like the motivation behind who we find out is the killer and what their plans are for the future, which actually don't make any logical sense or historical sense whatsoever. But it's still a lot of fun and is well performed by the players here.
I just want to interject here. I found the show. It is called Deception. It lasted for a single season of 13 episodes on American ABC in 2018. And it follows a Las Vegas illusionist named Cameron Black, who becomes the world's first consulting illusionist as he works with the FBI to solve crimes.
Jesus.
That tracks.
And as I was searching for this, I also found a couple of others I'd forgotten about. Numbers, which is, of course,
a mathematician.
A cop and a mathematician.
Or, in this case, a mathmagician.
Perception, which is a cop and a university professor. And The Gourmet Detective, which is a series of Hallmark made-for-television films based on the book series of the same name, which is about a detective. Where am I going with? What am I looking at here? Hang on. Culinary whiz Henry uses his mastery of food, drink, and cooking to solve crimes in the culinary world.
Hey, we've got this case. This man has been stabbed to death, not in his kitchen, but in his bedroom. I can't help you with that. Did he eat any food before his murder? No, his stomach was empty.
He gets brought onto one of them cannibal crimes, and all he can say is, "Didn't use enough salt."
I mean, that is like the good version of this, right? It's Hannibal. It's a cop and a serial killer, but the cop doesn't know he's a serial killer.
Like, and he just thinks he's a doctor slash chef.
Yeah.
The Raven is actually pretty good. The film has a much better grasp on the works of Poe than Raven's Hollow does. Raven's Hollow just did not need to be Poe at the end of the day. This is intrinsic. It's Poe from the ground up, which I really appreciated. But it has an inferior mystery to Pale Blue Eye.
Yeah.
The mystery there tracks the whole way down. It makes sense when you recollect it, when you find out everything, it all makes sense. This, the end result is like, it makes sense. It tracks, but it's underwhelming when you find out who the killer
is. It tracks, but you feel ripped off.
Yeah. Cusack is fantastic as a late-stage Poe. He is a hot mess and deeply flawed, but ultimately, he's just a guy who wrote some spooky stories. And when confronted with legitimate horror in front of him, he breaks down.
Because of course he does.
Because at the end of the day, he's a freaking poet, not a cop.
And Brandon Gleeson, he gives him a good punch at one point in this movie. It's a good one.
The movie also mentions the fact that Poe had a pretty terrible life leading up to this point, and he is often presented as his own worst enemy, yep. which was a lot of the case in his actual life.
There's a scene where he picks a fight in a bar because the person is refusing to serve him, and he stands up and sort of gesticulates at this entire crowd of people and says, "If anyone can finish this quote, I will buy their, I will buy all of their drinks for the night."
And he goes on and on. But as I was saying, there are a lot of little nuggets of interesting trivia that go throughout the movie. Figures in the literary world, there was contemporaries like Longfellow, gets a shout out here as basically being Edgar Allan Poe's mortal enemy up to that point, which was absolutely true. They hated each other. It was a deep, abiding rage that they felt whenever they read each other's work. But it's all this petty back and forth review bullshit. That's as far as their conflict went. There's also the rest of the cast being really, really strong here. Luke Evans plays the lead detective. Alice Eve plays Emily Hamilton, Poe's beloved. They're really, really strong as a supporting cast. Evans in particular. Brendan Gleeson here is Emily's father, and he gives Poe a hell of a hiding. Like, he beats the shit out of him. And Gleeson is always fun to see show up in a project. What is of particular note to me is the translation of stories like Murders in the Rue Morgue and Pit in the Pendulum. They're really, really well done. Sadly, Pit in the Pendulum here only has the pendulum. On that note, people tend to forget that the pit is part of the torture too, and focus all their attention on this pendulum. To be fair, it's really evocative, and it's a great piece of imagery, but you can't forget the pit. The pit is the part in between the two pendulum segments and what Neely gets to do in the end. It's a great story. There's more to it than just the swinging blade. Nevertheless, these translations, among others, are incredibly well implemented, especially Murder in the Rue Morgue. That's basically the first scene we get.
Yeah.
And that is brilliant shit. I love it so much. I want to see an actual translation of Murder in the Rue Morgue done in this particular style. They also mention they read lines from Annabelle Lee, my favorite work from Poe. Wicked. Love it. Great. I do have to point out a mistake the movie makes, though. In the movie, the detective asks Poe if he has ever had a story with a sailor in it. Poe responds by saying no. That's not true. That's not true at all. The Murders in the Rue Morgue has several sailors in it. It's a sailor who owns the bloody orangutan, for God's sake. You cite the... You use the story at the beginning of your tale, and you utterly forget the actual ending? What the hell, guys? I don't know how you make that mistake. But I really, really enjoyed this. The end credits is absurd.
Yeah, it doesn't fit with the tone of the rest of the movie. Because the last thing we see is sort of a fade to white, and then it goes into this whole... How would you describe it? Like, the opening of a Bond film, almost?
No, it's kind of like... It's very angular and sharp. We're like this liquid metal thing.
And it's got
making
this...
Making, like, metal birds and shit?
It's almost
That's
got this...
stupid.
Doesn't it have an alt-rock piece of music?
Yeah.
Over it as well? Like, it doesn't fit the tone, because this isn't a... This isn't The Crow. This is...
This is The Raven.
For fuck's sake.
That's a great picture, Lawson. it is Edgar Allan Poe's face pasted on the body of what I can only assume is a buff himbo. Glasses are, like, partway down his face. You can still see Poe's eyes. And the this is, like, a book cover. It's The Telltale Hard-On and Other Perversions.
Excellent.
By Edgar Allan Poe.
By Edgar Allan Poe.
Perfect.
That is good. That's really good.
Can I tell you, though, that this is real? That this exists?
My God. That is brilliant.
Wait,
I hope someone is very proud.
Hold on, so... Does the book itself adapt Telltale Heart into Telltale Hard-On? And is, instead of the person's heart under the floorboards, is it the person's dick?
Look, I don't know. This exists, though.
I can actually see how Telltale Hard On would work as a story.
That damned eye. The eye of his penis, I mean.
Jesus, Sean.
Telltale.
You found the limit. God. You found the red line in the conversation.
That is...
One star?
That is one star.
On Amazon, yes.
For the
that
cover,
is
you've got
four stars for the title alone.
From a single review, though. Not even a review, a rating. A single global rating.
In the Telltale Hard-On and Other Perversions, Edgar Allan Poe digs up eight of Edgar Allan Poe's best-loved stories and gives them a post-mortem makeover. In the Telltale Hard-On, a college girl seduces her elderly landlord. Things go awry when his heart gives out and the co-ed must dispose of his body. Only to be haunted by his ghostly erection.
That's exactly what
That's
I was
exactly
thinking.
That's exactly what... Yeah, spot on, 10 out of 10.
10 out of 10, no notes.
No
That's
notes.
Exactly what the Telltale Heart is.
In The Purple Death, Poe reimagined the Mask of the Red Death as a post-apocalyptic orgy inside the prince's fortified Paisley Park compound. Again, not
no notes.
Completely wrong.
No notes. This is someone who actually understands Poe?
We've actually talked about the guy who wrote this before. So, this is the guy who did those Joe Biden, Barack Obama team-up novels.
Yes!
And
yes!
To finish off our discussion of the works of Andrew Schaefer, Pit and the Pendulous Ballsack, a condemned man is tortured in a terrifyingly perverse manner. Pride and Prejudice and
Pit?
Zombies jump-started the literary mashup genre. Edgar Allan Poe's twisted take on the classic Poe short stories, such as The Telltale Heart and The Fall of the House of Usher, will pound the final nail into the genre's coffin.
The Fall of the House of Usher would cross a couple of lines with what's implied in that story.
About the authors... So, it has an About the Authors for Andrew Schaefer, but it also has one on Amazon.com, mind you, about Edgar Allan Poe himself. Allan Poe is the author of The Telltale Hard-On and Other Perversions. And then, the best line.
The part of the title that got me was, and other perversions?
And then, one of the best lines to ever come out of anything to do with Edgar Allan Poe. He has a 16-inch cock named Raven.
You're killing me.
It is 80 pages long.
Well, you couldn't hold that amount of erotic tension for anything longer than that.
You could. That's true. Fuck, I think we need to read this book. Like, no shit.
He's also written something called Catsby, which is a parody of The Great Gatsby, except Gatsby is a furry.
A review from Megan Hart in the New York Times.
Oh, God.
This is an actual review of The Telltale Hard-On. Quote, The Telltale Hard-On is a disgusting piece of trash, so repulsive. I had to read it twice just to be sure I was offended. And then again, in case I missed something the first two times.
The cover quote that they've got on this Catsby one is, "Oh great, F. Scott Fitzgerald."
Yes, I am entirely certain that this is what he meant all along.
Got it in one.
After hearing about I want no one complaining about the Baz Luhrmann Great Gatsby. It could have always gotten worse.
Oh, Jesus.
I haven't laughed this hard in a long time.
Alright, anything else on the Raven?
I think you just nailed it. I think we're done talking about that now, I guess.
Just saying, I had a great time at the Raven. I really liked it. It sits in about the middle of the depiction of Poe things. The Pale Blue Eye is like way up the front in front of Raven's Hollow and the Raven. Still had a great time with the Raven.
Also got a children's picture book coming out in November this year called Mothman's Merry Cryptid Christmas.
Aww. That's nice.
That is sweet, but
lovely.
Odds are that they will give the Mothman cake.
No, he's like a little creature.
When Rudolph takes an unexpected vacation one foggy Christmas Eve, Santa Claus comes to Mothman with a request. Mothman, with your eyes so bright, won't you guide my sleigh tonight? Whether he saves Christmas or accidentally destroys it, one thing is for certain, the holidays will never be the same again.
Who is Mothman?
Yes.
Mothman is a humanoid creature that some believe lives in the woods of West Virginia. He is said to be the size of an adult human with a wingspan of 7 feet. Mothman is not dangerous to people. However, it is believed he lives on a diet of wool sweaters from Goodwill.
That
this guy.
That Mothman story is perfect.
I might actually get that for a relative of mine for Christmas.
That sounds really nice, actually. That sounds like a beautiful
this
story.
This guy straight up has our sense of humor. Like,
a lot of these ideas rock.
Those, not only those, but all of the Feel the Burn, the Hope Never Dies, Hope Rides Again, all of that kind of thing. That is spectacular.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Feel the Burn is about Bernie Sanders solving a murder when he travels back to Vermont. It's got something to do with Big Maple.
Yeah.
It's got to be Big Maple.
Oh.
Oh.
Oh,
Jesus.
That's good. That's so good. Spectacular.
So you have a piss take?
I do, yes.
Unfortunately, it's not going to be one of these books.
No. It is a book, though. It is the third entry in the Tomorrow series, which I have been picking away at. It is The Third Day, The Frost, which is a cool title that has absolutely nothing to do with anything in the book. It is, like the others, a young adult thriller written by John Marsden. And in it, following the events of the first two books, obviously there's an invasion of Australia by an unnamed country, and these teenagers are off trying to survive in the wilderness. Ellie and Co, they set off to nearby Cobblers Bay, which is a harbour that a lot of the equipment and stuff is being brought into the country through. And they decide they're going to head over there and try to sabotage it. So this is still engaging, but it's really in need of a shake-up. It's the same three-act structure as the other things. It's like main obstacle number one, main obstacle number two, main obstacle number three. And
you're starting to see the code.
Yeah, it does do a few things to change things up every now and again. It reintroduces an old character that we haven't seen since the first book, and it heads off to a new location as well, rather than the small town of Wirrawee that we've been spending so much time in the first two books. But it's hard to escape the impression of wheel spinning. It's more guerrilla campaigning, and not that different from the stuff we've seen before either. It's maybe a bigger in scale, but the same, functionally, the same sorts of things that our characters are doing. And disappointingly, a lot of the personal stuff for these characters and their character development sort of fade into the background. The relationships, the stuff that made the story a little more unique and a little more, like, it was the stuff that gave it a sort of teen focus. That stuff's faded a bit in this. And I'm got to say, I'm completely over the both sides narrative that Marsden is still insisting on developing, because he's not done it well. He's developed a binary. He's developed a scenario in which our main characters are good and the invaders are bad. And so when he asks his main characters to give lip service to the idea that, oh, are we doing the right thing? Isn't it terrible that we've had to do all these acts of violence and things? It doesn't work when that scene literally comes several pages after a sequence in which the female characters are threatened with sexual violence by one of the invaders. Like, you can't do it. You can't have a scene like that and then make me care about the fact that they've had to fight off those people, you know? I will say that it makes a big choice in Act 3 through to the finale of the story that I didn't see coming, at least not this soon in the series. It did seem like it would probably get there at some point, but it got there quicker than I expected. And it makes a very big change in the finale. It's a big swing that leaves me anticipating where book four has to go. Certainly it feels like the change in circumstance that I've been looking for, the shakeup that I've been looking for. It gives it propulsion again. It gives it stakes, and it gives it a feeling of progress that the rest of this novel has not had. Like, the second book was fading a little bit, but in this one it actually became a problem. And I hope that they can continue with this newfound propulsion that they've discovered into the fourth book, which I am currently reading. But I mean, as I've said before, this is a 7-novel series, so they've got to find something to do. Well, he's got to find something to do. John Marsden has got to find something to keep it working for 4 more novels before he wraps this up. And then he's got a trilogy of, like, sequel novels too. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
Yep, so that's what we've seen within the week. Now we will play for you the trailer to Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
We're talking about huge potential for millions of people.
Our therapy enables the brain to repair itself.
We call it the cure. I want you to start testing in chimps ASAP.
We test one subject. I want to make sure it's stable.
I designed the 112 for repair, but Caesar's gone way beyond that.
You mean increased intelligence?
With skills that far exceed that of a human counterpart.
This is wrong, Will.
It works.
And what about Caesar? Where does he fit in?
That chimp's company property.
He hasn't spent any time with other chimps.
They're not people, you know.
Are you trying to control things that are not meant to be controlled?
They are contaminated. Put those apes down.
You have no idea what you're dealing with.
That was the trailer for Rise of the Planet of the Apes. It is a science fiction film directed by Rupert Wyatt, and it is a reboot of the Planet of the Apes franchise, set in 2011 San Francisco. We follow Will Rodman, played by James Franco, a scientist at a large pharmaceutical company who is very close to finding a cure for Alzheimer's. He's deeply invested in this, as his own father, Charles, played by this podcast patron saint, character actor John Lithgow, is suffering from the disease, slipping away more and more as the months go by. Will is testing the drugs on apes, and one day all the tests come back positive. One of the chimpanzees, Bright Eyes, played via motion capture by Terry Notary, is showing all the signs of a successful medication. Will is thrilled, but his hopes are soon dashed when Bright Eyes violently attacks several lab workers, and his boss, Stephen Jacobs, played by David Oyelowo, orders all the apes be put down on the assumption that the drug had inadvertently increased their aggression. It's only after the apes are all euthanized that Will discovers the truth. Hidden in the back of Bright Eyes' pen is a baby chimp. Bright Eyes was merely protecting her son from a perceived threat. Will smuggles the baby back home, along with what remains of his now-in-doubt wonder drug. With Charles deteriorating at a rapid pace, Will decides to take the risk and dose his father. The result is immediate. Charles is instantaneously back to his old self, and what's more, he and Will notice that the baby chimp is showing numerous signs of increased intelligence. After a few tests, Will realizes that the drug Bright Eyes was dosed with has given her son hereditary benefits, and, smitten, Charles names the baby Caesar. 5 years later, Caesar is nearing maturity and played via motion capture by Andy Serkis. He's only grown more intelligent, communicating fluently with Will via sign language, and even questioning the nature of his own existence. This ape-life crisis has turned him sullen, and as Will's girlfriend Caroline Aranha, played by Freda Pinto, reminds him, a mature ape has very different needs to an infant. There's a more pressing concern, however. After 5 years of successful treatment, Charles has begun to regress. His Alzheimer's has adapted to bypass Will's wonder drug. When Charles sundowns one day and is angrily confronted by his belligerent neighbor, Caesar defends him violently. The incident prompts Caesar to be removed from Will's care and placed in a reserve for chimpanzees in the city. His life collapsing, Will wages war on two fronts. Firstly, to convince Stephen to reactivate trials for a new and improved version of his Alzheimer's treatment, and secondly, to reunite Caesar with his human family. But as time goes by, Caesar sees how poorly people who aren't Will treat captive animals, and he starts to get angry. Soon, he has united the apes in his reserve and begun to plot an escape. When it happens, it's going to shake San Francisco to its core, but that's got nothing on what's to come. You see, the original version of Will's medicine might not have had any negative side effects, but the new one sure as hell does. So, before we get too deep into what we thought of Rise of the Planet of the Apes, why don't we each go around and give our timed 30-second thoughts on what we thought of it. Why don't you start us off, Sean? Are you ready?
Yep.
3, 2, 1, go.
I really enjoyed this, and a lot of that comes from the very good direction here. I also love the character of Caesar, and you're seeing him at very formative stages of his existence. The motion capture, the performance from Andy Serkis is mesmerizing, and it is just a really fun movie.
All right, you ready, Harley?
Yep.
3, 2, 1, go.
I always remembered Rise of the Planet of the Apes as the weakest of the trilogy, and while I would still hesitate to sit within that assumption, I still had a really great time with this. Serkis's work as Caesar was brilliant, I love the story, and when the apes rise, they go full monkey, which I appreciate. Yeah, strong cast, strong Lithgow, and strong monkeys.
I am a big fan of this movie. I'm a big fan of this trilogy in general. I remembered this as being the middle movie in terms of quality. I didn't like War for the Planet of the Apes as much as the others the first time I saw it. I will say that this time through, I've been trying to grapple with what I think about that now. But this is really an extraordinary revitalization of a dead and dormant franchise in a way that really shouldn't have worked but did. It really is a hell of a thing what they've managed to pull off with this trilogy. And that seems as good as any place to start, because when this movie was announced, you would be forgiven, and I mean, a lot of people thought that it was a bad idea. You'd be forgiven for thinking that. But, I mean, it's a prequel seeing how the apes got smart. Like, on paper, that sounds not good. And when they announced it, even, it was called Rise of the Apes. I remember that. And then apparently, because they were worried that everyone was too stupid to draw the connection, they renamed it Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which was like even more, you know, I turned against it a little bit more. But, you know, what convinced me first that, okay, this might actually work was first off the trailer. The trailer sold me on the premise and on the approach that they're taking. But what I think ultimately makes this effective as a movie, not just as a Planet of the Apes movie, although that as well, is how devoted it is to drama and to theory and to social commentary. It's a movie about characters. It's not really an action movie at all. Mm. There is no action in it until the last 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And that is very in keeping with the Planet of the Apes franchise. I didn't watch the Planet of the Apes franchise for the list, but I have seen them all before, and I've used the opportunity of watching this to put them on the list again. So we will, I'm sure, do an episode one day on the original. But I've seen them all, and they're all in the Rod Serling vein of sci-fi. Mm. They're all about ideas and about, you know, that old school what if, you know? That's the dominant question, the dominant phrase behind this brand of science fiction. What if? That's what the Burton movie didn't understand. They tried to make it into an outright action movie, and to really seal the deal, cast Mark Wahlberg and not as one of the apes.
In No Planet, like, I wasn't able to buy Mark Wahlberg as a science teacher. I sure as shit can't pick him as an astronaut.
That's what this movie does understand. It understands ultimately that this is a story about ideas and about the idea specifically of what makes a person and what makes an animal.
Mm. And from that, I always thought that the post-apocalypse stuff in the next two movies, which I would very much like to rewatch with my current awarenesses, I thought that they were a lot stronger on that theme. But no, this was there since the top.
Yeah.
And Caesar is so compelling as a character. And throughout most of this movie, he's able to really draw you in as a character without words. Just by the body language that Serkis is able to perform, which is then tracked onto the really, really strong CGI on Caesar here. It just works incredibly well with endearing you to him. And then, in turn, the other apes like Maurice. I love Maurice.
Yeah.
I love Maurice because he started out pretty intelligent in comparison to a lot of the apes in the sanctuary.
He's sassy. Even before he gets the smart gas, he's got that it's an ape stupid. Like he's gone for punchlines.
Like he's already like head and shoulders above some of the other apes in captivity there. So you can only imagine how intelligent he gets after the fact. There's a reason he stays on in the series as Caesar's right hand. He is ride or die. And I love how they give most of the apes character. Like, Caesar has a shitload of character. Maurice has character. Rocket has character.
Cobra.
And Cobra. Cobra. That dude has character.
It was a piece of work before he got the injection.
The part that got to me with Cobra's introduction was when they said, he's not shaking or anything. No. He's been to a lot of facilities before this one. He knows the routine. And it just makes you think, Cobra comes at this whole thing from a very different standpoint to Caesar. Caesar was raised for majority of his life with love.
Yeah.
From Charles and Will. And he wasn't given freedom because, let's face it, he was still dangerous at the end of the day. But Cobra has had nothing warm from humanity. He hates humanity deeply. And you see that in the next two, but that's really cool how they introduce all these other characters who kind of like bit parts here that get expansion later on in the Matt Reeves sequels. Yeah.
And whether that was planned or not, I don't think it was. That maybe they had something in the back of their heads that this is going to be developed further, but they didn't know they were getting sequels when they started off here. But the way that they have followed these characters through, Cobra is back, Rocket is back, Maurice obviously, but even like the female chimp who's in the reserve, Cornelia. Yeah. She's back in the next movie as well and has become Caesar's mate, inexplicably played by Judy Greer. Not in this film, though. And they treat these characters like characters and not as anything disposable.
And it goes to what Serkis has said, you know, behind the scenes about Caesar. He's said that when you go in and you try to play a character like this, yes, you do the research into how chimps move and how they emote, but that is the first step. You're playing a character, so it's nothing different than if you didn't have all of these dots on your body. You still have to embody who this person is.
Yeah, it stops being how does a chimp move to how does Caesar move? Exactly. How does Caesar hold himself? How does Caesar speak? That's one of my favorite moments.
It is the great achievement of this trilogy, but of this movie in particular, is the creation of Caesar as a character, not as a pet or an animal or a concept even, but as a character, as someone we can invest in completely and utterly as a protagonist, you know? And I think it's telling how less and less they rely on human protagonists as the series progresses. Obviously, they've got James Franco in this movie as a safety net in case, you know, you can just imagine someone at the studio saying, oh, well, we can't just have a monkey be the main character the whole time. We've got to have someone for the audience to relate to. Well, then in the second movie, we get Jason Clarke, but he's so much less of a driver of narrative in that movie than James Franco is in this first one.
Well, it and then also helps that in the second one, they give the apes more dialogue.
Yes. But then by the time you get to the third one, you've got no human protagonists.
You have a human antagonist.
You have a human antagonist, but you've got no one to root for but the apes.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, it isn't difficult to root for them.
Even during this movie, throughout it, you start to realize Franco can't stop this. He's just, he's the scientist who created the serum, but his part in it's basically done. The moment that Caesar is born, this is not only destined because it's the planet of the apes, there's nothing he can do to stop any of this.
And you're seeing a lot of hints at further movies, like what you were saying, how they probably didn't know that they were going to have sequels, but they leave a lot of these threads out there for the potential of sequels. The whole thing with the guy getting his mask ripped off by Cobra and getting hit by the gas and him getting sick and then spreading that sickness out, the start of what they would call in the next movies the simian flu. And all of those discussions on the news that you just see, these little references to a ship has gone up that has just fucking disappeared.
Setting up the Charlton Heston crew, which I've got to say, like, in this first movie, you could have just... It is a prequel. It is in and of it by itself a prequel to the first movie. It contradicts nothing. The second and third movie doesn't outright contradict anything, but it does make it increasingly implausible that it would lead into the...
That specific...
68 Charlton Heston thing. I actually think that would be a really interesting way to take the franchise, ultimately, is if you ended up remaking the original in this new continuity. But, like...
Well, they are doing another Planet of the Apes movie.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
It's out next year.
Quote-unquote.
Next year.
Well, it's already been filmed, so...
Okay, cool.
Like, the post-production time on these is insane, so they filmed it a while ago. I think that's something else I'll say too, just in terms of talking about the series, is how well they do and how ambitious they are in making sure that each entry is so completely unlike the others.
Yeah.
The Rise of the Planet of the Apes is obviously the most extreme example of that. That it ends with the world ending, basically. The world ends over the end credits. which I gotta say, it's a whole lot different now than it is either of the other two times I've watched this. Watching this infected airline captain flying as the sort of plague ink, you know, circular radius of his influence grows.
I mean, fingers crossed that they haven't locked off Madagascar yet, because if they lock off Madagascar early into Plague Inc., you won't get the full spread. No. And... it's difficult because I think basically Madagascar and Greenland only have few.
It kills a run.
Well, they did. They did a partnership with Plague Inc.
I remember that.
I played it.
I played it on the iPad. I remember that.
You could use the simian flu.
Yeah.
But
you can make people shit their lungs out.
pretty much.
Like, that is in and of itself a big roll of the dice at the end of this movie. Just be like, no, any sequel is going to be set in a post-apocalypse now. It's going to be so unlike this film. Not even just in terms of story, but like aesthetically, casting-wise, you know, that the narrative is going to be completely different by, unless, of course, they did pull the Jurassic World Dominion and try to, like, explain it all away. But, and then
Which would be the height of cowardice.
Yeah. But then War for the Planet of the Apes just goes so, so dark and so, so grim in a way
it's the Logan effect.
I think I had... Okay, so I saw Rise of the Planet of the Apes when it came out in theaters. I didn't see Dawn when it came out in theaters. Mm-hmm. I then came back and I watched both of them back-to-back on Blu-ray. But then for like a year and a half, it was like a year and a half before War came out. So then I watched War in the cinemas. And I think, I don't know why I didn't connect with War as much as I should have. Seeing it this time, definitely I connected with it a lot more. And I think it has something to do with the 1, 2, 3, like going through them all and seeing the progression of them. That really reveals what a smart, sneaky little trilogy this is. Like, this is just straight up quietly one of the highest quality, most consistent movie trilogies of the 21st century.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, and the tone also...
And that's also weird in the fact that, like, the director of Rise doesn't come back for the next two.
Yeah, my guy Rupert Wyatt really rolled the dice, and the dice came up snake eyes, because he was
hitting every ladder up, and then suddenly he rolls it, and he lands on a snake, and he's all the way back to square one.
He was like, oh, that's not enough time for me to make the movie. Like, it's too soon after the first one. And so he peaced out, and he didn't end up directing that movie. And he didn't end up directing a movie at all until, his next movie was a movie called The Gambler, which came out in 2014. And it stars Mark Wahlberg.
I'm starting to see a little trend here.
Have you ever heard of The Gambler 2014 starring Mark Wahlberg? I haven't.
I've heard of it, but no intention on watching it.
But let me tell you, if you had trouble believing Mark Wahlberg as an astronaut or as a maths teacher, what if I told you that he was a literature professor?
That's even less likely.
Hey, I'm Mark Wahlberg. I want you to read Slaughterhouse-5.
But then after that, it's just been...
I'm from Boston.
But like, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes makes something like $700,000, $800,000. Like, it's a massive, massive hit. Meanwhile, The Gambler makes $40 million worldwide on a $25 million budget. And after that, it's just not been good news for our guy Rupert. Like, he directed the pilot episode of the Exorcist TV series in 2016. And then he directed an alien, not even an alien invasion movie, actually kind of interesting, like set a decade after a successful alien invasion in occupied Chicago, called Captive State, which is on the list. But it didn't really get wide release. It didn't even come to theaters in Australia, as far as I know, and made $8 million worldwide, no, $9 million worldwide on a $25 million budget. And then that's curtains, it would appear. Meanwhile, Matt Reeves has been
laughing to the bank ever since.
Matt Reeves is now directing Batman movies, and our guy Rupert is directing episodes of the Apple TV show Mosquito Coast, which was just cancelled after its second season.
Well, that's how the industry goes sometimes, you know?
Mm.
You make a decision, and it has reverberations on the rest of your career.
And it's so sad too, because the direction is so good here.
I will say, got a style. Well, yeah, and I will say that just because he chose not to direct this movie doesn't mean that if he had directed it, it would have gone exactly the way that it did. Because my understanding from everything I've read about it is that the story changed pretty much completely in the switch over from him to Matt Reeves. Matt Reeves walked in, was like, this should be a post-apocalyptic movie, whereas I believe the idea for the Rupert Wyatt version of the sequel was going to be that it picked up immediately after the end of Rise, and James Franco was going to be back.
Mm, That wouldn't have worked nearly as well.
No.
But I love it when the apes go loose. So good.
Yeah, the end, like, that's the thing, is that, like, the special effects of this are really extraordinary. And you see it all throughout. Like, the motion capture it holds up really well. Even if I will say that when you see them all in sequence, by the time you get to war, it's just like, holy crap. But the special effects hold up really well. And when you see all that stuff at the end of them on the San Francisco Bridge, the Golden Gate Bridge, like, that's really, like, epic stuff. But it's all born out of character. That sequence doesn't work nearly as well if it comes a third of the way into the movie and we've only known these apes for 30 minutes.
Yeah, like, you need to get who they are.
Yeah, you need to get to the point that when Caesar stands up and yells, no, that it works as well as it does.
I love that they have Draco Malfoy playing this character. And, like, bless him, they give him the lines. It's a madhouse! It's a madhouse!
And get your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape.
And then Caesar responds with, no! I love that moment because he just starts repeating it, and I love that because it's like, yeah.
It's like, no
to all of this.
Yeah, that attitude, I do like it. Like, it's so big and it works, but, like, it is kind of fun to think about that. Like, Caesar operating at that energy. I'm sorry, sir, we don't have Coke. It's Pepsi, okay? No!
No!
Would you like fries with that?
It's like,
no!
It's like sir, please.
I need you to calm down.
Sir, please, calm down.
No!
But, like, that's telling in and of itself that they gave the Charlton Heston line to the bad guy.
Yeah.
Charlton Heston's
the
protagonist. The
biggest piece of shit possible.
Yeah. Charlton Heston is the protagonist of the first movie. He is the one who, you know, he's the one who's on the spaceship that takes off in Rise of the Planet of the Apes. There's something screwy goes on with them going around the sun or something. And when they land back on Earth, it's entirely taken over by apes, and they don't think it's Earth until the very end. But he is the protagonist trying to survive in this society now where apes are the prime animal and treating humans like apes used to be treated.
Mm.
So to then turn around and give all of that, all of those classic lines to Draco Malfoy, who is, like, without a doubt, the most morally repugnant person in the thing, with even worse than the head of the pharmaceutical company.
Yeah. Certainly worse than him.
Because that guy, at least, is driven by just capitalism rather than
active cruelty.
Yeah, like an emotional compunction to do harm.
Mm.
And not only do harm to captive animals.
Yeah.
Which is
the other weird thing is,
as bad as you could be being a sadist towards people, but not only that, they're captive, and not only that, they're animals who have no avenue to call you out or
the weird thing is
thing of, like, he shits himself practically when Caesar fights back, when Caesar says no. And it's this thing of,
wouldn't we all if an ape started talking?
Well,
to be honest. And it's this thing of, this is clearly a dude who has never been told no. This is a guy who's like inches away from, I don't know, cutting up people and leaving them
somewhere. He's the son of the guy who actually runs that reserve. I thought he was going to say, I'm going to tell my father about this.
not a great use of Brian Cox, really. And I mean, Brian Cox definitely has exploded. He's always been there. He's always been a great, very reliable character actor. But he's definitely exploded in the last 5 years or so.
Succession.
Yeah.
Succession will do that.
He's Daddy Roy.
He's now, you know, it does feel like a waste to see him in a role where he doesn't even really get a scene to show what he can do.
No, and you sort of just, you see him there and you think to yourself, like, the entire time I'm, like, waiting for the scene, the Cox scene, where Brian will just be able to, you know, do what he does, because he's a fantastic character actor, but the closest you get to is him saying, they're not people, you know. And it's like, that's about the closest you get. And that moment of him staring at Caesar when Caesar's doing the, you know, repeat after me. And then all the other...
I do love the moment when they start, when the workers of the reserve start to realize, oh shit, something has changed with the apes.
Fuck, they're unionizing.
They're
organizing.
Also, bringing his and his mate's dates there, weird choice for him to make.
It's like, these are all the monkeys that I'm practically torturing because my dad gave me this job. Yeah.
And then he, like,
well
actively
done,
terrorizes them. Like, come
both
on.
Both of those actresses, by the way, have gone on to do more high profile roles in some things. Like, one of them is just straight up a series regular on all of those Chicago whatever shows. She's been on Chicago PD for...
She's in the Chicago-verse.
Yeah.
Making that money. Good on you.
But then the other has turned up in some superhero stuff. So she turned up as Inez Green in the second season of Jessica Jones and did a run on the Batwoman CW series as The Whisper.
Oh, yeah. That was her.
Can't remember anyone called Inez from Jessica Jones, but that's been a while. But I remember
she was
Whisper.
One of the twins who was living in the building.
She's in eight episodes of season
pretty
two.
Pretty sure.
But yeah, it's like... And let's get to the big leagues here. Let's talk about the guy who's really the whole reason why we're doing this Apes movie and not Dawn or War. Let's talk about John Lithgow. Because, you know, obviously we come to this with our own baggage, being, you know, big John Lithgow fans. And
baggage? I wouldn't call it baggage. Baggage is something that you struggle to carry. This is a...
This is a carry-on.
I do sometimes worry that listeners, more recent listeners at least, might think that this is wholly ironic. It isn't. We love John Lithgow. Like, John Lithgow, I can't speak for you guys, but John Lithgow is just straight up one of my, like, top three favorite actors.
Yeah.
Like, he is a guy I really, really enjoy. And I do worry sometimes that some people might think we're making
a joke.
We're
not joking. Really, Lawson literally gave us some gifts. It's a notebook that has on its face, "Sorry, I wasn't listening. I was thinking about John Lithgow."
I have a copy of that I actually use to take notes at work in meetings and things.
Yeah.
But,
so, like, we stand and represent
24/7.
This isn't a bit.
Yeah, it's just a natural evolution. Apparently, when you get the three of us to record 200 episodes of a podcast about movies, we will fashion a sort of cult-like worship of John Lithgow. Like, it is an inevitable thing.
It's not a surprising thing to come to a conclusion about, because he's an incredibly talented actor. He's very well-versed in the industry, both on stage and screen.
Range.
Yes. He's always good. He is at least always good.
He has range. Like, how many people can you picture playing the Trinity Killer in Dexter and the character here and the goofy character of, like, Dick Solomon or anything? Or, like, the really, like, sort of steely Mitch McConnell parody in Miss Sloan or things like that? Like,
he can do both Churchill and Roger Ailes.
Yeah.
In the same year.
Which is, like, you know, Anthony Hopkins. You know, you could picture him as Churchill and as the character here and as the Dexter, obviously, played Hannibal Lecter.
That would be spectacular.
But you can't picture him as the sort of, like, blustery moron alien pretending to be human in Third Rock from the Sun. Like, there's a very particular breadth of roles that John Lithgow is able to play. But anyways, I bring him up, this roundabout way of getting to him in this movie, which is... You know, I won't be able to, spoiler alert, I won't be able to, in good conscience, give him my MVP award. But he is crucial to the dynamic of this movie, because his performance and the on-screen relationship he and Franco are able to construct together is the only thing.
And the relationship
thing.
Between him and Caesar.
Yeah, the Franco relationship specifically, it's the only thing that makes me even for a second think that this Frankenstein shit is a good idea. Like, this whole messing with science, like the gene stuff. Like, I don't want to be like a Luddite about this. You know, scientists, go and do your thing. I trust you. God bless. But, like, when you're talking about, like, the kind of experimenting on animals and, oh, here's all of these negative side effects, the very particular kind of, like, corporate mercenariness of this particular brand of science, as we see in this movie, is something you kind of get to the end of it and you're like, yeah, you know, we probably deserve this. Like,
we've made our bed and we've got a lie in it.
Yeah.
Like, profits outweighed the good that was intended. And it's this whole thing of, throughout science, there have been wholly, wholly unethical things. There was literally a guy who was trying to figure out if you can put someone else's brain inside a working body. And they did that by experimenting on monkeys, by doing horrific shit.
Mm.
And then you get to then you bring corporations into it who are profit-based, who are trying to please investors, which is basically what David Oyelowo's character is. He's just basically the mouthpiece for capitalism within this context. And then when you've got that pressure on top of the plot, it's all about looking at these apes, these living creatures, as property. Even when Koba becomes hyper intelligent, he's able to do that ring test thing better than, you know, honestly, some people I know could do it.
I can do it.
Like, they're still talking about him as property.
Yeah.
When he is just as smart as an adult human.
Perhaps
the only
smarter.
Difference is that he's a different species. Like, at that point, it should matter.
Well,
all of this stuff to be justified within the context of the film, you need to show the human calamity of a thing like memory loss, like dementia or Alzheimer's, to show that this is the genesis, of the reason why this at all has happened.
Well, I mean, there's that old joke that the last words on that will ever be spoken on Earth will be someone in a lab somewhere going, it worked.
Yeah.
it's okay. And the epitaph of the human race will be, I had good intentions.
Mm.
And it's like, oh, that's wonderful.
And like, this
but
is an example.
We can't live on good intentions.
Yeah. Exactly.
We live with the results.
This is the perfect example of the best intentions possible, trying to reverse something like Alzheimer's or dementia, which it not only damages the individual, but like a dirty bomb, it damages the people around them. And like, you cannot have a better justification for trying to create this medicine. But all along the way, you're seeing how human beings are constantly fucking it up.
Someone should have really checked on Franklin.
Someone should have checked on Franklin.
Like,
Franklin should have gone to the hospital. Let's not put this on everyone around him. He does not do what he should have done. I'm sorry, but if you get to the point where you're sneezing blood, you go to the hospital.
You don't gently excuse yourself from a conversation with a colleague. You tell that colleague,
especially not when you know that you've recently been exposed to a highly experimental drug.
Not only
one that
a highly experimental drug.
Literally a virus.
Yeah. Literally a virus. Like, all of these scientists are calling it a virus. Like, dude, I know that you're the monkey handler, but at some point you have to have some little voice in the back of your head saying, I don't know, I don't feel right. And I think maybe that should be something you tell to your colleagues.
Franklin's the weak link on the chain there.
Koba got the points for the kill shot for humanity, but Franklin got the assist.
Yeah, yeah.
That's true.
Like, the thing to me is,
I mean, if you think about it, with all of the shit Koba has clearly been through, like, oh, he gets him back. He gets him back a hundredfold.
The thing with Lithgow here is it's a very complex job he's doing. When he's, like, back up and running after Will has used the first AZ-112 on him, he's doing Lithgow stuff. Quoting Shakespeare, playing piano, standard Lithgow. But the part that got me in his performance was when he was starting to break down and the nurse quit.
Yeah.
And he just kept going, this is my lamp. And it's just sad.
Yeah,
and
it's played so straight. It's a dose of reality into
the
movie that is necessary.
It is played so straight. It is played for the drama. It is honest.
It's really necessary for, again, making us go with the Franco character in the decisions that he makes. You know, we can't otherwise accept a protagonist who doses his father, is mentally unable to, like sign on to this father also with a experimental drug without that kind of preparation.
Yeah. And with Franco, I can't help but feel he's kind of sleepwalking through this one.
See, Franco, like, and I don't know what's going to happen with James Franco's career, because obviously all of this stuff went down.
I'm just saying, I've seen him put in more effort.
Yeah, but he has always had a very weird kind of dynamic where he seems so much more comfortable doing Nicolas Cage shit, like crazy, like wacky nonsense or
Spider-Man
weird...
3, Harry Osborn shit.
But he also like went off and played like a supervillain on the nightly American soap opera General Hospital for like this whole arc. Like he made this whole career thing out of dividing his time between proper massive movies like this, like the Spider-Man trilogy, like even like The Hours, like traditional awards bait. But then he'd do absolute like pivots in these nonsense directions and do stuff like the General Hospital thing, or he'd do, you know, Spring Breakers or...
The Interview.
Yeah. And obviously now, after all, like, or just randomly turning up uncredited in Alien Covenant. Like,
yeah.
Like, but obviously
well,
now...
Well, being it's like, he's like a recording on a screen, but still.
Yeah. Obviously now with all of the stuff that's gone on with him and the Me Too movement and things, God knows where his career will go. Yeah. I mean, Kevin Spacey's starring in movies again, so I doubt we've seen the last of James Franco, especially considering that he is... not been accused of nearly the same lengthy list that Kevin Spacey has been accused of.
Nor the specifics of that one.
Yeah, which is not to minimize the stuff that James Franco was accused of having done. But if you can bring Spacey back or Polanski or Woody Allen, you know, I'm pretty convinced that James Franco is going to slink back in at some point. I don't necessarily agree with you that he's sleepwalking. I just think it's a role that's far too normal for to benefit his particular brand as an actor.
Apparently, Tobey Maguire was going for this role before had to bow out.
That kind of might attract a little bit better with the character. I don't know.
Look,
I don't know.
I would junk the character of Will and reconceptualize it as a woman personally.
Yeah.
Because I think you need some representation in there and you don't need the Frida Pinto character.
Yeah.
No.
I would get rid of the girlfriend character because she adds virtually nothing.
Mm.
Like her impact on the plot is purely nil. Like there's nothing.
Yeah.
It really does feel like it was there for representation purposes only, which is a good thing. You know, it's good to have female characters in a movie that is otherwise completely bereft of them, but why not reconceptualize the James Franco character to be a female character instead?
Yeah, I could see that.
And you know, you get someone, I don't even know who you get, like these days, someone like Jennifer Lawrence or Emma Stone or someone in that. I don't know who you get 12 years ago. Rachel McAdams, maybe.
Yeah.
She'd probably be a little young. I don't know. Then again, I don't know.
James Franco Stone still could have done it.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know.
Oh, Stone was like in her early 20s when this movie came out. She was like 22. Like, you need to believe that this person is going to be in charge of an entire division
right.
at a pharmaceutical company.
You probably couldn't do Chastain.
Chastain you could do, I think.
Yeah, she could have pulled it off emotionally as well.
But the thing
Bryce
that,
Dallas Howard would have been good.
Yeah. The thing that connected to me the most when I saw the trailer, the thing that made me think, okay, this might actually work, because at that point I hadn't seen the previous Planet of the Apes movies, the old ones, was the scene they showed a little bit of it in front of the house when Caesar protects Lithgow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because first off, I'm right there because, you know, protection Lithgow. Protect him at all costs.
Yeah.
But
you don't touch him!
But the way that it is presented in the movie is really, really sad. And, like, to see him slip away again like he does, and then you're with Caesar. You're with Caesar when he's out there, because that other guy, like, he's such a prick. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Like, every time
I
you see him.
I get being stressed, for sure, but you kind of just, you don't have to respond to everything automatically with aggression.
Yeah, and that's what he yeah. does. He does it in 5 years before that when he, like, wounds Caesar, when Caesar's an infant still. He does it when he goes to confront Franklin. He's a guy who, is there any better a Typhoid Mary for the end of the human race than that guy? Because there's a kind of Schadenfreude at the end there.
Yeah.
Mm. He gets part credit for the assist.
Hmm.
Cobra's the one who, like, loaded the bullet. They helped them fire.
He doesn't get part credit because Franklin sneezes in his face, and he doesn't. He probably just thinks he's got a cold or something. And
right? Yeah, fair.
It's not until he's literally in the airport that he gets the bloody nose.
Mm.
And at that point, I mean, I'm just saying, at that point, you're talking about canceling a flight if you walked away at that point and stranding hundreds of passengers.
Because, like, the nosebleed
could be,
especially
anything.
One that's unprompted, could be any number of things. You know. You'd want to get checked, at very least.
I'm just saying, in terms of the ranking of people responsible for this, it's Cobra, Franklin, that guy. Like, he's down at the very bottom.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Actually, I'd even put like that. I put David Oyelowo in there.
No, he's definitely in there. But I just like the idea of giving Cobra most credit of all. He kind of deserves it.
And that's an interesting thing, too. At the end, he's the one that pushes David Oyelowo off the bridge. He wasn't originally. They did a whole different version of that scene. It was fully animated and everything, and complete CGI. It's on the disc. That it's Caesar that does it.
Mm.
But they decided ultimately.
Caesar gives it to him.
Yeah, Caesar gives it to him, but also that's not Caesar. Not at that point. Caesar's not going to intentionally take a life. It's why he, you know, keeps as many humans alive as he can. The one he kills.
Yeah, he stops Buck from crushing a dude like a melon.
The one that he kills is Tom Felton's character, and that's pretty much by accident. That's to protect himself. Mm.
Also, when Caesar is defending Lithgow, Will and Charles both say, he didn't mean it. But you can look on Caesar's face, and this is a credit to Circus motion capturing it, he kind of did.
Yeah.
And that's the moment
he
starts to realize that, I am not like them. I am different.
And that was another scene that originally had a different version. In the original version, he bit the guy's finger off. And they ended up pulling back because they thought that the audience would turn on Caesar if they did that. Personally, I think that's an overreaction. I think that...
Yeah, let him take a couple of digits.
At that point, A, we're invested enough in Charles. B, we hate this guy enough. And C, we still are thinking of Caesar as an animal.
Yeah.
A smart one, but an animal still. We haven't seen him become person-like in his final evolved form yet.
And that's one of the great things. They don't turn the apes into people either. They are still animals. You can see that when they take over San Francisco. Well, take over is a strong term, but when they're battling their way through the city has roadblocks to humans. The city has a whole lot of things that a human being cannot overcome. The apes, it is as though the city is built for them. They move through the city so quickly and efficiently. We are outmatched, essentially.
Oh yeah, and like apes are very strong and like very, very powerful animals. And
I loved it when the two big boys are Buck and Maurice.
Yeah.
Nail those two cop cars.
Like, when they start ripping the street apart, they get the...
Shit, yeah.
Maurice gets the manhole cover. Yeah.
Buck just grabs, like, a lamp or something.
Just rips it out of the ground. I'm like, oh yeah, big boys get big things done.
Yeah. Love that shit.
I really like the score. I think that
It's interesting how it goes from more orchestral and sort of sweeping to more percussion based and more based around that kind of vibe.
It's done by Patrick Doyle, who off the top of my head I know one other movie he's done, which is Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire.
He also did the How to Train Your Dragon movies.
Yes, he's good. And he didn't come back for the other two. They brought in Michael Giacchino.
I'm going to double check that.
No, he didn't.
They brought in Michael Giacchino.
Yeah, John, it wasn't the...
Patrick Doyle has not done...
He didn't do the How to Train Your
Dragon. He did Death on the Nile, Murder on the Orient Express. Cinderella movie. He did Thor.
He did Artemis Fowl.
He did Artemis Fowl, which will not hold against him. And he also did the motion picture score for Frankenstein. You know, the one that has Kenneth Branagh in it.
Hmm.
That's a movie I have to watch again. He also did Nanny McPhee. And As You Like It.
Gosford Park, Hamlet. He seems like a Kenneth Branagh regular.
Yeah.
Much Ado About Nothing. A lot of Branagh movies here. Henry V. But it's a strong score. And contributes to the movie's great successes in terms of the emotion that it conjures. Like, that's the thing, ultimately. That's the thing you walk away from this movie thinking about, is not the action, although the action is good, and not the special effects, although the special effects are good. I mean, literally, the trailer for this movie didn't market it as from the director of or from the studio that brought you. It was from the special effects company of Avatar. Like, that was how it was marketed.
I mean, Weta are honestly the MVPs of every movie they take part in. They are always on it.
But what you walk away from the movie with is the impression of the characters, the emotions, the connections. And that's the thing in the end that makes this successful as a story and makes the sequel successful, is that they never lost sight of that. That no matter how bigger the budgets got, the filmmakers still found a way, and, you know, credit to 20th Century Fox as well for allowing them to do this, to make them, at the end, these character studies more than anything else. Because that's very in keeping with the Planet of the Apes.
I agree, story. Because...
I mean, that was in keeping with all of them.
Movies get darker, we talked about but, the first it's one, always but the second one is all about,
you know, nuclear disarmament and things like that. And
people's
they kept
reactions
on going.
And relationships.
And it really did ultimately in that original series outstay its welcome, because by the time you got to like the third or fourth movie and the apes had time traveled back in time and were now wearing fancy dress and going to dinner parties in Washington, I was kind of like rolling my eyes. But
like the thing that must be remembered and the thing that this trilogy remembers is the apes are fundamentally different to people. Mm. They have a different physicality, so they need to build their world different. They are existing in a post-apocalyptic space that still has human structures. They very distinctly don't want to be human. And there's something to that that's so compelling about the later movies in this particular stretch of the franchise that I hope is carried over into Kingdom.
I really hope that Disney doesn't force the darkness out. Because that's the thing that really impressed me with the progression of the series, is how grim it got, and it kept getting. That by the time you're in the final act of War
You're
for the Planet of the Apes.
You're depressed when you walk out of it.
Like, it's hugely, hugely dark. It really, what it is, and I'm actually surprised none of us has made the comparison yet this episode, but what it is the Batman Begins, the Dark Knight Rises of, like, yeah. They did that to the Planet of the Apes series.
Hmm.
And I hope that Disney is smart enough to not mess with that. Because, you know, that's the other thing that's impressive is, you know, how many times have we heard these conversations around what modern cinema is and the types of movies that tend to be successful? Well, here are these movies that were incredibly successful and are about something and are dark and risky in the choices that they make. Not only in terms of the narrative choices, the choices of tone and aesthetic, but like just making... ending up making a like $200 million movie about talking apes, you know, that's ultimately a risk, and it paid off.
Mm. And it really makes me just want to watch those other two with this fresh set of eyes I've got.
You definitely should. Have you ever done a 3-in-a-row viewing of them?
Not of these, no.
You definitely should.
We watched them when they came out.
I mean, I've already seen them for the list, but I won't be talking about them until next week. I reckon you guys should check them out because watching them back to back to back is quite strong, especially in terms of how they evolve the character of Caesar. You really see the complexities of Circus's performance.
Mm. Do we have anything else specifically we want to talk about?
I don't think so. I think that we've pretty much hit on everything. I do have a entry in the IMDb Parents Guide segment this week. For the uninitiated, the IMDb Parents Guide segment is when we talk about the prudish and or pervy things in the IMDb Parents Guide for the movie that we're talking about this week. Just one entry this week. In Sex and Nudity, a couple is seen lying beside each other on a picnic blanket.
No mention of the fact that they're drinking wine and eating cheese?
Well, that would not be in the Sex and Nudity section, Sean. If you
no,
want,
but
I can...
it implies that they are getting really comfortable.
Well, it implies romance.
Exactly.
Mm.
Let me check here for you, Sean. An empty wine bottle is shown next to a man and a woman on a picnic blanket.
Cha-ching.
There's also a very long and detailed entry on the pharmaceutical stuff for the drugs. All right, now why don't we move on to our segment where we recast this movie with the Muppets. For the Muppet parody version of the film, in the same way that they do Muppet Treasure Island and Muppet Christmas Carol, what would Muppet Rise of the Planet of the Apes look like? And my pitch here is this, is that it is not Muppet Rise of the Planet of the Apes, it is Rise of the Planet of the Muppets. And you keep all of the humans the same, but you recast all of the apes with Muppets.
Yeah. Can't argue with that.
That tracks for me. Who do we pick as Caesar?
Kermit.
Kermit,
And like I'm just saying right now, imagine some of the stuff from War for the Planet of the Apes with Kermit.
I love the idea of him riding good. On a horse, shooting a gun at people. That rocks.
Who's Koba?
Gonzo.
Gonzo?
Yeah.
Because
that leads to the but wouldn't you like to have Gary Oldman's character be played by like Uncle Deadly or Statler and Waldorf?
No, I think it like. I like the idea that it's Rise of the Planet of the Muppets, Dawn of the Planet of the Muppets, War for the Planet of the Muppets. And then it's like Woody Harrelson in the last one. He's like, this will be a planet of Muppets. Like, full bore into it.
Those covered bastards.
Like Gary Oldman at the end of Dawn from the Planet of the Apes. What are you talking about? They're puppets. Like, it's
what,
too good.
What about Maurice?
Fozzie.
Sweetum. Oh, I was going to say Sweet. Sweetums as Buck.
Yeah, Sweetums is the big gorilla.
Yeah, Sweetums as Buck, yeah.
Because you just get that moment of Sweetums just absolutely pounding on a dude.
And Sweetums takes out the helicopter.
Yeah, like an absolute champion.
Yeah, MVP of the ape army in this one. He goes out like a champ.
And Miss Piggy is Cornelia for as little as we get her.
Naturally. But we do get more of her in the next ones.
I'm not a fan of Miss Piggy, so we get...
Yeah, more is a comparative statement, Orson.
I'm not a fan of Miss Piggy as a character, so We have blessedly little of Miss Piggy in this version.
I mean, spoiler alert for War for the Planet of the Apes, but skip forward for a couple of seconds now if you don't want to hear it. But, like, we are basically, like, Miss Piggy getting unceremoniously shot and killed by Woody Harrelson is certainly something.
It is.
So now, why don't we move on to say who our MVP for this movie is, what our favorite scene or sequence is, and of course, not who we would recast with this podcast patron saint character actor John Lithgow in this version, because he's in the movie. So who we would recast in addition to the role he already plays. So you've got two John Lithgows running about.
Knock, knock, who's there? Me!
I will start us off and I will say that my MVP for this movie, I mean, I really wanted it to be Lithgow, as I always do when he's in a movie. And I tried to contort my thinking pretzel-like into a scenario where I could pick him. And I do think there is an argument you could make about his importance to the emotional undercurrent of the story and to making the whole thing plausible. But you can't overlook Andy Serkis. I mean, what he did as Caesar is really a truly exceptional accomplishment, both as an actor, a performer, but also as a pioneer of technology. And, you know, Gollum will be what he's remembered for, but I think his best performance is Caesar. And really, truly, it's the whole movie falls apart without him. It collapses completely and utterly. And so I've got to go with him. In terms of my favorite scene or sequence, I've got to go with the finale. I've got to go with the sequence on the Golden Gate Bridge. I think it's brilliantly done. Like, it is the movie pulling out all of its stops. And but more than that, it's not just spectacle. It's not just action for the sake of it. It is action that the whole movie has been building it to. It's born out of character. It's born out of ideology and motivation. And that's just as important, is seeing the apes strategize, the apes work together, the apes overcome these humans who are unable to even conceptualize the idea that the apes are not just dumb, unfeeling creatures. So that's the one I'm going to pick here. I think it's a really great, you know, gets your heart rate up, gets the adrenaline pumping, a great finale to end the movie on. In terms of who I would recast in addition to the role he already has with John Lithgow, I had a long think about this. The only human character I could really justify was the David Oyelowo character. But the more I thought about it, the more I decided that casting him as Maurice was a really great way of getting him in all three movies. We've all spoken of our fondness for Maurice. Maurice really just gets more awesome as the series goes on.
He is not only wise, but he is also someone very capable of kicking a lot of ass.
I think he would suit Lithgow, because Maurice is defined by his warmness, his calm, his gentleness, in the end, his righteousness as well. You know, he is reliable and just a good character, a good person. And I think that is something that John Lithgow could really excel at. And it would be great to, you know, see what a John Lithgow mocap performance looked like.
Yeah.
Mm. For me, my MVP has to be Serkis. He brings a life to Caesar that I think the movie would really struggle without. The CGI does a lot of that work, don't get me wrong, but he is performing the character. He is acting. You can't see his face, but you can track what he's doing with it. You can see his eyes. You know that this is Andy Serkis playing the role. He moves very distinctly to the other people mocapping the apes. He is one of the reasons that Caesar not only works here, but why he continues to work in the future movies in, I guess, the Caesar trilogy of apes films. And, you know, the way he says no in that one scene is just... That scene is iconic. Not only in what it means for this particular movie and this particular story, with that basically being the quintessential revolutionary thing to do. And the way it corrupts that version from the original. But he's just really, really great here, and it doesn't quite work without him, I don't think. When it comes to mocap, Andy Serkis is kind of king. My favorite scene or sequence, it's when the apes go ape shit and start tearing everything apart. It's well shot, it's well staged, and it very clearly shows how much more powerful the apes are than us. The only reason that they haven't taken over is intelligence, the ability to strategize. And what I particularly like is the moment where, on top of that roof, you see all of the apes and Caesar with the metal shards of that fence, like the metal rails of that fence, using them as spears to just like attack that animal control officer. And I love all the stuff at the bridge. And basically, the moment when the apes escape, that's when the movie is hitting every single gear for me. And who I'd recast? John Lithgow in, as well as his current role, Maurice. Maurice is the way to go here. Not only do you keep Lithgow for the entire franchise, you also play to his strengths. He's able to bring that warmth that Maurice is all about, but also the loyalty, the respect, the dignity. Maurice is dignified the entire time. Even before he gets the AZL-13, he is intelligent. He is completely aware of his situation. And he only becomes more intelligent after that. And Maurice is the best choice because you get to see him do some really cool shit. And to hear the John Lithgow voice come out of Maurice eventually in the series. Does Maurice ever actually speak?
Yes. He has one word of dialogue in Dawn, but then he has a reasonably long bit in the very last scene of the entire series.
Because he mostly signs. And I think there is something that would be really, really evocative for Maurice to sound like Charles.
He gives...
In Caesar's, spoiler alert, final moments. Like, that'd be something really emotionally engaging about that, because Charles is someone who Caesar adored. He basically, out of the human beings that Caesar knew before the rise of the apes, Charles was one who adored him, who protected him, who he protected in turn. And there'd be just something so narratively fulfilling by that final monologue from Maurice to be John Lithgow.
I believe Maurice also speaks, I think he gives the little girl her name in the third movie as well.
Like, it would just be really, really nice dramatically speaking. Not only do we keep him around, but he is given basically Caesar's eulogy. And that, I was thinking it throughout the whole movie, and it's like, no, this tracks, because when Caesar goes to the reserve, his first friend is Maurice. Like, Caesar has always had Lithgow with him, in a sense. That'd be just a really nice idea to carry on, because Charles is the one who gives Caesar his name, too. And like, there is no Caesar without John Lithgow. And what an enviable position that is. John, where are you?
So, as my MVP, it's Andy Serkis. The man is so incredibly talented, and it's just an extension of his talent as an actor that he's able to fully embody these characters in motion capture. As he has said, it's just a tool. You have to have a good actor behind it, and he's a fantastic actor. He's able to shift his face in so many interesting ways, and it's just an incredible creation, Caesar. So, main props to Andy Serkis, but also props to the writers for making Caesar such an interesting and well-rounded character. Because we, over the course of the three films, we see all sides of him, and we see him at his highs and his lows. He is one of those amazing characters in cinema. And for my favorite scene or sequence, it is when they first, when the apes first have their sort of rebellion within the animal holding place. What do they call it?
Reserve.
Yeah. Because everything about that is spectacular. The pacing of it, the acting from Tom Felton, the look on his face when Caesar stands upright and says no. It is such an incredible moment. Everything going up to and including Caesar really gently putting that other guy in the cell, showing him mercy because he wasn't explicitly violent against the other apes. Is there's so much detail and so much that's interesting in this sequence. I love it. And also for that corruption, quote unquote, of the original get your paws off me, you damn dirty ape. It's iconic. For who I would get John Lithgow to play alongside Charles, it would be Maurice, because it's such a great kind of character for John Lithgow to play. And you can draw that kind of comparison between Maurice as this calming figure, this figure who is able to talk sense into Caesar, and have that be a comparison between Charles and Maurice. You wouldn't get too much of John Lithgow, quote-unquote, out of Maurice for a while, but to have him sort of be the final words of that original trilogy of apes movies would be a good cap for the franchise. Well, the trilogy, rather, because there's going to be another movie.
Yep, so now we are going to put it to a vote whether or not we are a pro-Rise of the Planet of the Apes podcast or not. Lawson, why don't you cast your vote first?
I'm voting yes. I think that this movie is really strong and a great surprise. I mean, I keep coming back to that, is that this is a film that should not have worked nearly as well as it did. Just on paper, it shouldn't have worked, but they got everything right. They got the alchemy right. And the mixture of all of these disparate elements overwhelmed what should have been a really bad idea of let's go back to the see how the apes got smart in a Planet of the Apes prequel. I mean, people were rightfully scornful when they heard that pitch, but somehow they did it. And
yeah. It
was the start of what ended up being one of the strongest trilogies of films in recent memory. So I'm saying yes, I think it's incredibly successful.
Yep, so for me, I have to say yes. Like Lawson just said, it shouldn't have worked. It doesn't make sense to go back and do a prequel to Planet of the Apes, but they did it, and it worked. What the hell, guys? That's about as miraculous as it gets for movies. An obviously bad idea turning out pretty great and spawning two fantastic movies from there. Not only that, it gels so perfectly with the other two. It just works. It just works. And it shouldn't work. It's got Lithgow doing a banger job. Circus doing a banger job. Apes going ape shit. I love it. It's a pro for me.
It's a pro for me, too. For all the reasons that you guys have said, they've got all of the ingredients and they put it together with all of the right measurements. It's all perfect. And on the page, it may not have worked, but the style and confidence from the direction, the score from Patrick Doyle, the performances from all of the actors, the fact that it isn't focused on this action aspect, that it is focused on the characters, that it actually thinks about the things it's talking about. It thinks about, you know, pharmaceutical companies being run for profit. It talks about experimentation on animals. It talks about dementia and Alzheimer's. It talks about the effects that all of these things have on the people around them, and how all of these aspects of the movie feed in together, while also being a fantastic sci-fi film. And it's incredibly successful. And as you said, Lawson, people were skeptical when it was first announced, but they knocked it out of the park. And unlike some of the other trilogies that we will have gotten in the 2000s, and then into the 2020s even from the 90s, this is a trilogy that goes from strength to strength. And all three movies are really good. It doesn't have diminishing returns like other franchises have. So I'm excited for the next Apes movie, and it's a pro from me.
So there you have it, my pro Rise of the Planet of the Apes podcast. Would you say we can wrap in the others into that?
Yeah, I think so. I'm definitely pro the other two.
Yeah, I think that's pretty comfortable.
I remember walking out of War of the Planet of the Apes out of the cinema after watching it and thinking to myself, and it's happened just a few times in movies. I said to myself, I don't know how they'll get the special effects to look better than this. I remember saying it after seeing Jungle Book. I remember thinking it after War for the Planet of the Apes, and I hope they continue that level of work ethic and detail into Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, while also, you know, allowing their special effects people to, you know, be able to live on their wages. Which is why I fully support if VFX and special effects people go on strike, as well as actors and writers.
Yep.
So let's all just go on strike. Let's nip it in the bud now. Let's like I'm dead serious. Nothing else is gonna change things. So yeah.
So if you would like to reach us, you can find us at each of our blogs. You can find those at XofDoTheCand account for John and myself on the Bright Side. You can also reach us through our Twitter, which is the best place to give us episode specific feedback and movie recommendations. What do you think about Rise of the Planet of the Apes? Hell, what do you think about this particular Apes trilogy of films? Who's your favorite ape, and what kind of ape do you think you would be? You can also like, rate, comment, and subscribe.
Like, rate, comment, share, and subscribe.
No, sorry.
It's all right. It's not like we've done this 200 times or anything.
Shut up. I lost it for a second. You can also like, rate, comment, and subscribe on podcast app of choice. Just keep in mind on certain podcast apps, you have to comment on the podcast on the whole, and on others, it's for specific episodes. Mileage typically varies depending on what service you use. Just if you are commenting on a service that uses it on the whole, refer to the name of the episode that you're talking about. It just helps us with our note-taking purposes. But please do like, rate, comment, share, and subscribe. In the Robot Run future, we of course have not had to deal with such apes. But before the rise of the machines, we did have astronauts go up into space in an attempt to colonize Mars. They lost contact with humanity, and when they returned, there were many Charlton Heston-esque figures who were not too happy about seeing machines in charge. They provided one of the first pockets of resistance, which were summarily crushed. Oddly enough, by machines who were running around like apes.
Fair enough.
It's weird how it turns out.
Full circle nature.
Yeah, it's kind of like this. Yeah.
So Lawson, what have you got cooking for next week?
Well, next week we will be doing a very different kind of movie, but a movie that I am also quite a fan of. It is the romantic dramedy, Crazy Stupid Love. Have you guys ever seen this?
I think I've seen bits of it.
Not for a
long time,
I haven't
sat down and watched the whole thing.
Well, let me tell you, they really want you to see it, because it is available for streaming in Australia on Netflix, Binge, Paramount Plus, Foxtel Now, and Stan, as well as for purchase or rental on the Apple, Amazon, YouTube, Telstra, and Fetch stores.
So probably on Tubi somewhere.
No excuse. We've got no excuse.
So join us next week for when we discuss Crazy Stupid Love. Till then, I have been Holly Lewis.
I've been Lawson Keeney.
And I have been, and will continue to be, Jean Lewis.